welcome back to the Glove Podcast. My name is Gabrielle Love. I am your host. We're back with another psychedelic session, and this one I am particularly excited about because there's such a variety of topics that I think we're going to be touching on. Neuroscience, where psychedelics are going, you know, the space, where is it going, where is it headed, what are some things that we have concerns around. Publicly traded stocks, that's another big one that I personally do love talking about, and I'd love to hear from our guest what he has to offer. Without further ado, James, welcome to the Glove Podcast. Feel free to take a moment or two to introduce yourself.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Without divulging too much information, I'm just going to say that I have been, I think, a quiet onlooker on this space for years. I would say 4 or 5 years now. I'm kind of an outsider looking in and watching the research on this and kind of the social acceptance of it grow, and seeing the presence grow on things like social media, on podcasts. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, there wasn't 100 podcasts on this subject that you could look up and find, and now there is. And now I feel like finally, after doing kind of my own experimentation and learning, I hope that maybe I have some perspectives that might be just a little bit different or unique, and maybe someone can benefit from them. So I was hoping to share that with everyone.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. I'm sure that sharing is welcomed. It certainly is for me. Let's start with your experiences. How did this all start for you?
I'm going to get emotional just talking about that. I have a very dear friend. I won't use his name. He has no idea I'm talking about him now, but I have a dear friend. We'll call him John. John introduced me first to actually the electronic music scene, which ties into one of the topics I wanted to bring up later. But at the time, it was, 100% about the music. My first show, it took him months to talk me into first going. You know, I had never really been to any live music ever. I grew up in a tiny town. It was just one of the things that I didn't do all even through college. And then he finally convinced me to go. The first one I went, we drank a little bit, but I had a blast. I just noticed that the environment was extremely welcoming. It's not like going to many bars or clubs where I feel like you show up with your group, you migrate to a safe section of, there's a little spot, either if you're lucky, one of the bars that has maybe an outdoor area and, has a table or some seating that isn't taken. You get there, y'all talk about, if someone's going to go get a drink or two, or y'all are going to go get drinks first, go get your drinks, come back to the same spot. And you sit there and kind of people watch and, catch up or whatever. But really there isn't much interaction unless typically you either have some very confident and extroverted friends that will engage with other groups or other people throughout the night, or several of or some of your group are single. And in the case you don't have one of those two things, you're pretty much just your friends going out and drinking. And this just was a completely different experience as far as being in a environment where people by default are going to compliment you or are going to interact with you, or, and it's just completely opposite, just a completely opposite environment from what the typical Saturday or Friday night looks like for people that want to go out and party. So that kind of first ignited my passion for that scene. So then I graduated from just drinking. If you want to say graduate, it's a weird word to use. But eventually he introduced me to and gave me the opportunity to try MDMA. And so then that kind of was, and I feel like this is a natural progression. So that was like unbelievable, life-changing thing, just feeling kind of a euphoria on that level was great. But for a while, and I can look at it in hindsight now and say that that became motivation to do it for a little while. I couldn't wait to go to a show, not necessarily because I cared who was playing, but because it was a chance to take Molly.
Right.
And then over time and like actually listening to the music and kind of getting over my first couple of times rolling, I realized that just like alcohol, that drug has a come down and it has a hangover. Mm-hmm. And I think that it has a place, and I think there are ways, and I've learned, I feel like, you know, ways to do it more intelligently and safely. And there's definitely a place for it. And I love it. It is definitely not like I feel any worse about it, but it definitely has a hangover. And that was something that I learned to respect. And then not long after, he'd offered me a couple times to try some LSD. And I kind of was very, very afraid of it. And I think that that's a normal response. You know, I grew up in the dare, just say no, or whatever the program was when I was in school. And it was just this ultimate, you know, take one of these drugs one time and you immediately become,
right,
you know, whatever it is that they tell you you're going to become. And so I was just scared. I didn't know what to expect. I think that's what it was really, is just kind of the fear of the unknown. And then one night he wasn't there, but it was all mutual friends that I'd met through him. And we were just sitting at a table. I think it was St. Patrick's Day weekend about 5 years, 4 or 5 years ago. And they said, hey, you know, let's drop some tabs like right now. And in that moment, I just said, fuck it, and put it under my tongue. And that was my first time taking it. Now, this is by far probably the worst setting I could ever recommend to anyone. I went back to a different friend's house, tried to get ready. That's where I had my come up. He sat with me for hour and a half, played music videos, let me listen to music, kind of get through my peak. Right. But then we basically went out to a packed bar and bar hopped until like 3 a.m. This all probably happened. My peak was probably at 7, 8, but rode out my first trip in a packed bar. He was not really helping. He wasn't hurting, you know, he'd check on me, but I was basically left to my own devices. And it was extremely disorienting, extremely rough, but in the moments where I could kind of feel like I wasn't, you know, out of place in every way possible, because I really was, but felt like it at least, it was amazing. And I knew that after, even though it was kind of like a rough way to get introduced to it, that I kind of was drawn to this more for some reason. I really wanted to know why and how everything could change, where I feel like MDMA, you know, colors were maybe brighter, sounds were better, but this just took things initially. I was just totally fascinated by the visual phenomena. I said, how can something like this work? You know, is it changing the physiology of your eyeballs, or is it something in your brain? Is it, you know, is it actually interfering with the way that you process information, you know, kind of on the front end or on the back end, or is this just something that changes how you process everything? And that just kind of ignited my interest. And so in that case, it was kind of a scientific, there was a scientific aspect of, you know, I want to know how this worked, why it worked the way it did. And then I think the following experiences gradually started to get closer to, I think, what I would recommend for, you know, anyone, whether you're experienced or inexperienced, but kind of taking it in safer environments, controlled environments, where I either had time to prepare and or I had control over where we were or weren't going, that kind of a thing. And that kind of allowed me to really explore all of these subjects kind of in depth, but that was kind of how it started.
Cool. All right. So your very first one, not exactly the best scenario to find yourself in. However, it did manage to pique your interest.
Yes.
Specifically, you wanted to understand the science behind it, which I think is just absolutely amazing. And so how long ago was that first experience?
That was
if I can remember correctly, and I want to rewind for 2017. Oh my God, how long has it been? 2014, 2015. It's 2015 or 2016. So 5 or 6 years.
Okay, cool. So that's quite a while ago. So since then, you must have learned quite a fair amount of, around the science.
Yeah, so I think that I probably, I was much more, I was, my interest was peaked, but not to the point, I didn't feel like I didn't have enough to work with to really dive in as far as to explain what it was I was even seeing.
Right.
So I think it took about another year, and in that year, maybe 3 or 4 more experiences with it. And then again, in common controlled environments where I could really pay attention and I wasn't worried about spilling my drink or 100 people screaming around me or whatever, you know, other stimulus there was, I could really just kind of focus inward. And in that time, I finally started to kind of dig into the science. And it's funny how now, and what I love is how much has taken off since then. But back then, really the big organization that you could look back at was MAPS, the multidisciplinary association for psychedelic sciences, if I'm not butchering that. But MAPS, headed by Rick Doblin, who's an amazing guy. If you don't know the history or the background of either of those, the guy and the organization is really phenomenal. But so that kind of catapulted me, and they're the ones who I know are, he is currently championing MDMA as the, basically the choice treatment modality, MDMA psychotherapy for the treatment of PTSD. So that really went, I went, wow, you know, this is not only, that was my first real, like, this is not just a party drug. You know, when was the last time that you heard, you know, of any other drug of abuse being championed as treating something that really is no treatment, great treatment for? So I just, that was when I went, whoa, okay, there's something real here. So I paid attention to that for a very long time. And then gradually, more research started coming out. Imperial College of London, Johns Hopkins University, other places. And I don't really know when the turning point was or when I really got turned on to Robin Carhart-Harris. But as far as I'm concerned, Robin Carhart-Harris has kind of zeroed in on a theory that I believe is the best theory of what happens to us, to our brains, to our minds under, you know, these substances.
Right. And is this, sorry to interrupt you. Is this theory, does it apply to, you know, psychedelics across the board, or is this in reference to a very specific psychedelic?
So this theory, is more about consciousness in general. And
Gotcha. That's
kind of what, I started to learn about as I learned more about these substances was that I never really thought of the idea of a consciousness, even the concept of it being outside of or possibly not related to the matter that is within your skull. And as I started to have more of these experiences and find out that other people were absolutely establishing, you know, science that says that it might not be, or maybe definitively we know that it is not, and we just don't know where it is or what it is. And that has kind of just been the itch that I can't scratch, just the thing that I can't let go, that is just like the most amazing thing that we don't know. And when that idea, I think, becomes more mainstream, I think they will get even more more attention and more money to kind of get into this research. But before I kind of launch into that, I don't know if there was anything else you wanted to stop me on before I went into his theory.
No, I mean, I definitely want to hear the theory. But before you do that, yeah, I'm totally with you. I mean, consciousness for me is definitely the most fascinating thing. It's like at the top there. And the fact that we haven't figured it out yet, it's just incredibly exciting to me. So I'm excited to hear about this theory.
Okay. So to actually directly answer your question you asked me a minute ago, it's definitely not about one psychedelic or one drug. It's in general addresses anything that expands or affects your consciousness. But I think in this case, when they do mention psychedelics, they are referencing classic tryptamine derivative psychedelics, ones that affect the 5-HT2A, which is a serotonin 2A receptor. These are the things you think of, like LSD, psilocybin, containing mushrooms, DMT, variants of DMT, whether it's NN-DMT or 5-MeO-DMT, kind of these traditional psychedelics.
Right.
Not MDMA typically would not be included in that. Things like MDMA, MDA, or sassafras, or ketamine, things that are dissociatives, or phenethylamine based psychedelics. These are kind of the traditional, you can think of as the big three that most people would think of as acid, mushrooms, and DMT.
Right.
So what I'm going to get kind of now into the theory. So what is so interesting to me is that his theory finds a way to reconcile this experiences you have under the drugs we just talked about, as well as religious or mystical experiences you can reach during fasting states, mm-hmm. During meditative states, maybe during REM sleep, kind of puts all of these different states of consciousness into an actual context that it makes sense. So of all those states I just listed, those he posits are part of primary consciousness. And the secondary consciousness that we are in now, and every day and every part of our waking consciousness, is what typically people explain it as. Our secondary consciousness is a very ordered and structured consciousness. It requires us to reduce uncertainty to the highest degree that we can, so that we can do the things that our egoic mind wants us to do, proliferate, succeed, win, protect, things like that.
Right.
So in order to do those tasks as effectively as possible, you want to make things the least chaotic and the least disordered as possible. It's difficult to do those things if you are in a state of intense disarray, or you are uncertain about how anything or everything in your life is going to go. It's very difficult to feel in control. I think that's an easy way to think about it is, you know, the more orderly things are, the more control you have. In your mind, what really needs to happen for you to access these primary states of consciousness is a lack of order. So a very easy way to think about this, and I think for everyone, is think of a child's mind.
Mm-hmm.
When a child is young, they're almost, you know, it's like a dog chasing its tail. It's chasing and doesn't know what it's going to do with it when it catches it, but it just is. There's so much joy in whatever thought or stimulus or emotion or whatever it is kind of comes to you. And that childlike state of, you know, what is this? I'm going to put it in my mouth and I'm going to taste it and I'm going to figure out what it tastes like and what it feels like. You know, I might throw it across the room to see how it bounces. Just that kind of like fully experiential mode of your mind is, you know, you're not worried about, is this going to hurt me? Is this going to break? Is this kind of all of these things that we don't think of as really just your mind trying to reduce all the ways that something could hurt you in day-to-day life. It's just and it's just a preservation state. So if you think about any of these other states, the psychedelic state, and maybe deep meditation, REM sleep, religious mystical experiences, in these states, you are not concerned with, am I going to get attacked right now? You know, it's very difficult to maintain, you know, some of these other states, maybe a deep meditative state, if you are concerned with, am I in physical danger? You know, is someone going to hurt me in this moment? Kind of a thing is just like a religious or mystical experience. If someone is having a very powerful experience, they're probably now this is where there's kind of a fork here, and I don't know how he posits this fits into his theory. Now there are near-death experiences, and I don't know if you've had anyone on that's kind of talked about that and maybe what they experience in that state. I would say what they are experiencing is their consciousness shifting into a primary state in anticipation for or preparing for the death of their physical body, because they are no longer going to need to worry about, you know, are they going to be hurt or
right.
And, you know, they don't need to think about what they're going to eat. They don't need to think about the safety of their family because they are no longer about to be physically tied to this world in any way. And that's their consciousness kind of shifting away from that secondary state of consciousness that is so concerned with keeping us alive and trying to reproduce and keeping our minds as ordered as possible. So that's kind of an overview, and you can kind of look at this in some different ways. And maybe the way we look at mental illness, someone who's depressed, you could think of that as an overly ordered mind about the past,
right?
You know,
or the future,
right? Or you could look at the future as maybe anxiety. They are construing this hyper analytical, superly, overly ordered way of thinking about how they're going to react to, you're right, you know, things that are coming up. How am I going to act during this phone call? I'm going to screw it up in this way and that way and this way. And you're creating all these little branches off this tree of, you know, what's going to happen and how am I going to screw it up this way and how am I going to screw it up that way? But right, you're in the past or in the future, but it's kind of this hyper rigid structure that you fall into of anxiety or depression, kind of worrying about past future differences there. But essentially this theory would posit that your ability to kind of move away from that hyper rigid structure in your mind. And of course he goes into very deep, the neuroscience of it, basically works on decoupling your default mode network from your temporal lobes, which if they kind of research into briefly the neuroscience around, you know, how psychedelics work, they're all going to say, oh, it's shutting off the default mode network. The default mode network is where the ego is seated, etc. If you dig a little bit deeper, that is not technically true. It is more about modulating how the default mode network communicates with other parts of your brain. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're finding is that, you know, in these fMRI studies, when people are in these states, very deep meditation states, you bring in someone who's been practicing meditation for 40 to 50 years, and compare that to a scan of someone who's in a psychedelic state, and it's a similar effect. They are changing the way that their default mode network relates information across their brain and puts them into what he would posit as a primary state of consciousness. And why this to me is so exciting is because this is a way to scientifically show people that it's not just a quote unquote drug experience, which to me is the hardest thing to get through to a lot of rational people, but also just the mass public. They think that what you experience on this is the same thing that someone might experience, you know, on a meth bender on your third day of sleep deprivation and, you know, meth use, that the things you're believing or thinking are probably similar to what you're doing on psychedelics. And I just do not think that that is the same thing, that this is a way to explain how it's not really a quote unquote drug experience, that the experience is within all of us. And it is a function of, you know, something that your consciousness achieves just with the help of, you know, these substances.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And you know what? Thank you for sharing that theory. It makes a whole lot of sense. The part that was interesting to me was that sort of shift in perspective around that being the way the brain modulates or communicates or relates that information, rather than it actually being the state itself. But this is a good segue into one of the things you had mentioned was the pathway to mainstream acceptance of psychedelics. And it's actually a really good segue into several things. I'm assuming that what you're going to be talking about in reference to that is that pathway being something along the lines of using psychedelics, you know, to treat various mental health illnesses, the way, like the research that's going on, the many publicly traded companies that are out there. And I believe there are several index funds as well, if I'm not mistaken. But is that sort of where you're going with that? Or is there a different pathway that you see happening here?
So I agree. I think it's a good way to kind of segue into this different area. So I could see it going a couple different ways. What I hope doesn't happen with these publicly traded funds, and I don't want to mention any of them by name because I'm going to, you know, say things that I don't like about some of them, and I don't want to accidentally say the wrong thing about the wrong company and put out, you know, information, bad information. But essentially, this is what I don't want to happen. I have heard, by heard I mean read, that companies are trying to find ways to basically convert this into this experience into, you know, a pill that they can prescribe. And the only way they can do that is by taking this subjective experience, which is a, you know, this shift in consciousness from a secondary to a primary state. And they're trying to get rid of that and trying to just focus on a drug that can target and hit these receptors and hopefully give the same benefits without people actually having the experience.
Right.
And to me, if you listen to or read this research, I don't think it's going to work. So I'm hoping that because it won't work, it never even gets, you know, packaged and sold. But I am worried that with the way we are as a people in a society right now, that people are going to say, oh, wait, I can get all of these benefits and I don't even have to risk a quote, you know, bad trip or a challenging mm-hmm. trip, or I don't have to do the work of, you know, maybe the preparatory and the integrative, you know, counseling or therapy that I need to do along with it. I can literally just take this pill that, you know, I can now get and is now going to become an assimilated, you know, section of big pharma that gives me all these benefits. And if that was the case, like I am, you know, anticipating, it's not going to work and psychedelics are going to be kind of discounted. Now, the other way that could go is they're going to find out it doesn't work and it's never going to get that far. And I hope that's the case. But I think that what Robin Carhart-Harris and the team over at Imperial College London have posited with this entropic brain model does gain traction, and maybe the research points to it really being, you know, the truth or grounded in a part of large part of the truth, which would mean that those drugs wouldn't work. You know, the experience is very much a part of the healing or the, you know, what a person brings back that matters. I guess the biggest analogy, because it's one of the only things I feel like that, you know, you can think of that's, you know, of a similar undertaking to a very, very intense psychedelic experience. You know, say you're going to summit Mount Everest, and I know there's months of planning going, so maybe it's not that extreme, but for a lot of people it is. You know, a lot of people to work up the courage to do something like this, that is weeks or months of years of waiting before they can do this. So imagine you're going to summit Mount Everest, but instead someone offers you, what if I could just fly you to the top and you can take a selfie up there?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see these, you know, packaging these substances as, you know, here's the benefit or here's the final product without the work. And I really hope that that is not the direction that it goes. And I would really hope that there are plenty of companies. I think one, if people want one to look into, it's not listed on the New York Stock Exchange yet. It's still an over-the-counter, kind of like a penny stock. But Field Trip is one of the brands that they currently have ketamine-assisted clinics. I think 3 in the United States now. And they're also starting the world's largest psilocybin containing mushroom cultivation facility, I think in Jamaica. So if you kind of look into that company, are definitely going about it the right way. And that's kind of, I think, a segue into another question you had in there was, what is the right way? Or if I could see, or I would, you know, guess what would be the right way or the best way for it to go forward, if those are the wrong ways, would be for the current research to continue, and with a model that is currently, you know, in effect, which typically is you get some preparatory sessions to talk about maybe, you know, what you want to address or hope to address or work on leading up to the experience, and then the experience is monitored. You have 2 people in the room with you in a controlled environment, and they're with you in case, you know, you think it's rough, and they are trained. At least one of them is kind of a mid-level, if not a doctor, a mid-level meaning like a nurse practitioner or a psychiatrist or an MD, obviously at the highest levels. And the other one is someone who's possibly just trained in therapy or specifically in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy and doesn't need to necessarily be a prescriber or a provider. Now in this setting, you kind of have all the support that, you know, you would need to successfully make it through one of these experiences. And then there are integrative sessions following where you get to go back and talk about what happened. And I think that is a very large piece of what is missing in kind of recreational use, which I am not, you know, I'm not a critic of recreational use like a lot of people I think that are advocating for psychedelic therapy. But I really think that integrative piece is very important, being able to figure out and talk to someone who, you know, will listen. And not just your friends. I don't mean that in a bad way, but a lot of times they don't, you know, have the tools to understand maybe what you were going through. And professionals or someone who's very experienced in our country, that is, you know, these mental health professionals that have been through the training in other countries, it might be a shaman, it might be any other kind of religious or spiritual leader, but the concept is the same. That you need someone who is experienced and maybe knows the territory to help you understand maybe what you went through. Otherwise, it can really lead to people having existential, you know, crises or leading to existential type of depression, which are very real things. I am also not one of the people that says, you know, this is a panacea and it's going to fix everything and there's no problems or no downsides whatsoever to people consuming these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point that you brought up. I, you know, it's actually not occurred to me up until you brought it up that, you know, if we look at, for example, cannabis and the way that, you know, was recently legalized, or at least in Canada it was, and now it's sort of this widespread thing. We've got tons of stores opening up. There's just tons of shops and people are just going out there and having a day with it. And now if we draw a parallel and imagine that happening with psilocybin in a couple of years. And it's funny because I was talking about this yesterday, probably. I could see it happening within the next 5 years. And now that you've brought this point up, that is definitely concerning because the idea of psilocybin just being widely accessible to people without the added sort of seriousness that you were alluding to, that could be problematic. I mean, I could see tons of people just going in there, having a bunch, being unprepared, not really understanding the way this works, certainly not understanding how it affects their brain, and then running into lots of problems. And then that, in the long run, of course, there are challenges for people in experiencing things, but also in the long run, that could end up biting us all in the butt, because in the long run, we're going to be looking back and we'll have all of this evidence that people are going out having psilocybin and having just horrendous experiences all across the board. Because in the long run, you know, that's just not good. If we're not doing this in a safe, ethical and smart way, it's just not going to work out for us in the long run. And so, like, I'm really, really glad that you brought that up. It's definitely a point of concern. I'm not sure how to solve for that though, because on the one hand, I can see pharmaceutical companies or just companies in general, you know, racing to the finish line just to be able to package it and profit. And I don't think they, like the majority of them, I don't think they're necessarily interested in also providing information or some sort of program along with that. I think most of them just want to package and sell it. So, like, yeah, how do we solve for that problem? Do you have any ideas around that?
So I think that something that's been kind of proposed by Rick Doblin and others is after it, and this is all assuming that it successfully makes its way into, you know, psychedelic assisted psychotherapy settings medically. This is assuming in, you know, a couple years, 3 to 5 years from now, it becomes something that a psychiatrist or some other mental health professional who is trained and has prescribing authority and, you know, can do it, can bring people through these sessions. After that has been around for a couple years and it is a proven safe model and it's a safe substance, you know, just as a part of public acceptance, just like you mentioned, the same thing happened with cannabis. How long was it medically legal before everyone went, holy shit, this works and it's safe and it's not bad for you, like we were told? Kind of a similar path. But eventually, I would hope that it maybe breaks out into, might sound funny saying it, but a type of psychedelic spa where it's not necessarily, you don't need someone like a nurse practitioner or a medical doctor or a DO or whatever the medical provider is in your country. Maybe it's just someone who has training or experience, and this is where it gets hard, because then you start thinking about, man, is there going to be a licensing body? Are we going to add bureaucracy into this? You know, who's licensed or certified to open these spas? But I don't have the foresight to see exactly how that should be handled yet, but just in general, the spa idea. So someone doesn't necessarily have to have a mental illness in order to benefit, because that's where I feel like people, giant portion of the population is left out with the current research. Obviously, this research is for people that are hurting the most and stand to benefit the most, and that's how I think it should start. But I think there are plenty of, you know, otherwise, quote, well people that want to expand their consciousness, that want to explore, you know, what is their, you know, concept of what is real, explore the concepts of love and empathy and kind of where we fit into the universe, what is the universe, all these kind of questions that are directly interfaced during these experiences. And I just don't think that that should be limited to people that are, you know, going through illness. So in this psychedelic spa, maybe it's someone, if you want to keep it licensed or registered in some way, maybe it's a nurse. You know, there are psych nurses, LPNs or RNs all over the country that work in inpatient and outpatient settings that have experience with working with people who are going through all kinds of variety of psychedelic, you know, states, not psychedelic, psychotic states. So they've seen, you know, people at their worst and people at their best, and they've, you know, kind of seen the range of behaviors that go along with it. So maybe someone like that would be the minimum to be there in case something happens. But maybe you could, you know, see maybe there's one or two rooms in this spa, and in each one, maybe there's one sitter who has some experience and is there just in case you need things. You know, you need water, you need food. This is the person who can go and get them so you don't have to leave. Things like that. People that have access to, that give you the TV remote, people that give you access to control of the music. Kind of take away all these little decision-making things that can lead people kind of astray, maybe in getting the best or, you know, the most out of their experience, so you don't have anything to worry about. And this was a way that, you know, when you show up, you give them your car keys. You know, maybe have a nurse there to try and screen them for, you know, medical conditions that might preclude them from participating, things like that. That's why I mentioned nurse might be the right kind of professional to be involved, but at least now you're kind of reducing this from, okay, you need a doctor. Okay, now you need a nurse practitioner. Well, now all you need is a nurse there, maybe with, you know, someone else on call to help them in case something goes wrong that they can't handle. But at least in that way, you have someone who is very experienced, and then individual sitters who maybe don't need a nursing license. And it's just a place where people can come and have an experience in a safe, controlled environment. Maybe home for them isn't a safe, controlled environment. They don't have somewhere to go where they can get 8 to 12 hours uninterrupted in an environment that is conducive to these experiences. And so I think that just having that space in the form of one of these spas, I think, would be a way, again, for people who maybe don't have, you know, a specified or diagnosed mental illness to kind of get in on this. And then after those spas are maybe in effect for a couple years, we could then maybe have the discussion about how to like educate people to safely do it on their own and go to legalization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. This is a great sort of timeline that you've come up with. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. Like one of the things that came up for me was I'm imagining us, you know, a few years from now, we've got a licensing body in place, and now there's all this red tape that you have to, you know, jump through in order to actually either facilitate these experiences, be a part of that process in some way. There's just all of this red tape. And for me, like, that is problematic in and of itself, because many of these psychedelics, like, for example, psilocybin, as well as ayahuasca, these are experiences that lots of people have been facilitating and having on their own in many different cultures, if you look at South America or Latin America. And so to exclude, say, a shaman who has, you know, knowledge that's been passed on from generation to generation and, you know, lived experience and has all this insight to offer, to exclude that person, I'm just using a shaman as an example, to exclude that person from this practice or these experiences that could be facilitated in, say, you know, a psychedelic spa, that's very problematic. Though, you know, I completely understand the need for ensuring that it is a safe and controlled environment. And I completely agree with the science and understanding things from a scientific lens as well. That said, I do think that there also needs to remain room for people that just have been using psychedelics for much longer and have a different perspective and understanding to offer that I think, like, we would do well to include that insight as well, rather than just sort of excluding it and fixating on just, you know, a scientific lens. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. And I should say, and maybe I should have prefaced with that, but if it were, this is what I see as kind of what's necessary and definitely not what I wish could happen. I have a very, very, it's like, I'm like one, you know, very, very loose tie, but I do have, I don't know, it was 5 or 6 generations back, related to the Kootenai tribe, of North America. And I do not know their direct history, but I know, for example, in the Southwest, Native Americans, Native American James. Indians used,
You just cut out for about 30 seconds. So the last thing I heard was 4 to 5 generations back, and then you cut out.
Can you hear me better now?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, perfect. I will cut back to where I was and cut that last bit out. But basically, if it were up to me, and we weren't in or had to deal with, I think, kind of the situational circumstances of this country right now, I wish we could just adopt kind of the system of what you mentioned of shaman, of people who have done this, or in the knowledge associated with it has been passed down from generation to generation. I personally have a couple of friends who have had hundreds of these experiences, and I trust them more than I might trust a nurse who has worked in a psych ward in a hospital, even if they've worked there for 20 years. I trust a person who has done what I am looking to do hundreds of times more, So I completely agree. And I don't know what the best way to include them in this would be. My first initial knee-jerk reaction would be, again, you then have to create the power structure of who gets to say that they're good enough or whatever. But I would say, what if there was a body? And I'm just going to use MAPS, just because MAPS seems, for the most part, universally respected. And say that MAPS created a team of people who ran courses. And if you could come there and get through that course, they were then, decide, I believe that you have, the experience necessary to guide people through. But like you said, I just feel like that would be almost impossible to do in different societal and cultural contexts, just because something that, the way that they have seen or been a part of psychedelic therapy might work a certain way, and in a different part of the world and a different context that works a different way. It just feels very gatekeepy, which, like you said, I think we want to try to avoid. So I guess kind of back to what I said is, I wish I had prefaced and said that these are the steps I believe are necessary in order to get widespread public adoption of these, the simplest. Now, if it were up to me, the substances would be made legal everywhere and people would approach them with intelligence and respect. I just don't think that currently I just think that's too much to ask with the way that we abuse other, substances. Just look at the alcohol culture in the country. I worry about a similar thing happening, kind of history repeating itself like it did in the 60s and 70s, where if it is totally let go and people don't approach it, like you said, ethically and safely and intelligently, that the hammer comes back down from the government and we kind of ruin a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely one of the things that I'm concerned with, and just the exclusion of certain groups of people from this entire process. But yeah, this has been an incredible conversation, James. I sincerely appreciate everything that you've brought to the table, and I feel like there's way more to unpack here. I think this conversation could definitely go on. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to part with?
Final thoughts would be to point people in the direction of, if they want to look further into the things I've mentioned, it's a simple Google search. If you Google the entropic brain, Robin Carhart Harris, it'll be the first article that comes up. It's very long. I will preface that it is, it's very long and it's a lot of, technical reading, but if you can even try to skim, you know, you can read the introductions and the last four or five paragraphs. If you can't, stomach, you know, the technical neuroscientifical jargon that you have to get through for the whole thing, try. And the things that, you know, are a baseline understanding, I think there's enough there for people to kind of get a framework for where this all comes from on a scientific basis. And I think that helps a lot of people who claim to be, you know, logical and rational, and a way not to discount a lot of what we talk about with so much reverence and joy as just a quote, drug experience. And I think that's really the last thing. Just kind of point them in the direction of that. A bit of research, since that was, you know, a lot of what we focused on, and just to start looking into maybe some of these companies like Field Trip Health or Compass Pathways. And I guess don't jump at the first opportunity. If you're someone who's relatively new to the space, or maybe you've been here for a long time and you think that, man, you know, Compass Pathways is the first publicly offered one, you can jump on your, you know, your brokerage app today and buy into it. But I would just say research first, read about what they are trying to do with the substances before, you know, buying in or supporting companies. Just because some of them, I don't feel like have the best interests of individual people in mind, and it's going to be more about money, along with the rest of kind of the bad sentiments of quote big pharma. So, those are, I guess, my parting words.
Beautiful. Those are great parting words. And yeah, thank you for all of that. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'd love to have you back sometime if you are open to it.
I would love to come back. There's a couple things that I would love to talk about more. I'd love to kind of get into the subjective experience itself. Through all my, you know, time learning about this, there's still so much that I think is just really fun to talk about and kind of compare to other people's experiences. We can kind of gonna get into a conversational trip report and just kind of talk about stuff that I think is fun to talk about, instead of quite so much stuff related to policy and kind of current situation concerning legality and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I love it. That's great. I have to say, you're either psychic, you know, you're just picking up on, you know, where my thoughts are at, or there's just a ton of coincidence happening, because that was exactly what I wanted to do more of, you know, if I had you back on as a guest. And so I'm just happy to hear that every single time you're kind of like throwing certain themes or ideas my way, it matches what I was thinking. So it's pretty cool. Awesome. Thank you so much, James, and we'll talk to you next time.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to coming back.
Right on. And that was another psychedelic session with James. Whew, man, the last few episodes have just been incredibly informative, and also with pretty much a very scientific lens, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. Like, I I'm just really enjoying that. And then I'd like to have more of that. So if you're listening and you think that you also, you know, are passionate about the scientific lens on psychedelics or the research, or, you know, where we're going, you know, with psychedelics in the mainstream, are, you know, legalization, using psychedelics for medicinal purposes, all of that stuff. If that's something that you are interested in, if that's something that, you know, gets your tires going, I don't know if that's the right expression, but, you know, if that's fun for you to talk about, please do reach out to me. I'd love to have you on as a guest, because I've really been enjoying digging deeper and deeper into that aspect of things. But also, you know, and this is why I'd love to have James back, I also want to hear about his experiences, because trip reports are also great. They are equally welcome. Well, thank you for tuning into the Glove Podcast for a psychedelic session. Once again, thank you for all your support, for listening, for tuning in.